Hello, and welcome to Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence, a podcast featuring employees and subject matter experts from domestic and sexual violence services and partner organizations discussing all aspects of interpersonal violence while providing prevention strategies, solutions, and resources for support for residents of Fairfax County. I'm your host, Kendra Lee. On this episode of Unscripted, I'm with Domestic and Sexual Violence Services ADAPT Counselor Irvin Hernandez and Darla Timberlake, Clinical Director and Vice President of the Behavioral Health Center for Child and Family Services in Newport News, Virginia, to discover whether people who cause harm in relationships really can change. Irvin and Darla, welcome to Unscripted, and thanks for being on the podcast today.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Before we start, I want to remind our listeners, if any part of today's conversation triggers strong emotions, please call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. We all change, right? We mature and outgrow childish behavior. Experience sometimes teaches us to adjust our beliefs or political leanings. People quit smoking and give up other addictions all the time. But when it comes to domestic violence and whether people who harm those they say they love can turn that behavior around, change is a much more complicated discussion with no easy answers. So, Irvin, I'm going to dive right in with you. Can a person who harms a partner change?
Yes, that is the first and I think most reassuring answer that a lot of individuals need to listen, individuals and couples or anybody who's struggling with this or who has struggled with this. Yes. They can change. We're talking about, for the most part, and I know that later we will probably go in detail about this, but we're talking about behaviors. And behaviors can be changed, can be reinforced, can also be reframed, we can teach ourselves to relearn different ways to communicate, different ways to react to things, different ways to solve problems. And I think that is something very important to once again remind anybody who's struggling with this, but also remind ourselves that this is the work that we're doing has an important payoff. An important payoff is trusting and believing that individuals who cause harm or individuals who have caused harm, they can change.
Darla, why are we, and when I say we, I mean the general public, why are we so inclined to believe that people are unable to stop harming people that they say they love? We think someone who smokes can quit, but we don't think someone who causes harm can. Why is that?
I think that a lot of people see people that cause harm as bad and evil. You know, this is a crime. Smoking cigarettes, you don't look at them and think of they're bad or evil. But I think people are looked at as bad and evil, which they're not. They may be doing bad things. But everyone is inherently good. I truly believe that. And I believe we can get people reconnected to the truth of who they are. But I think a lot of people see, you know, they're bad, they're evil, lock them up, don't let them out.
Okay, so let's talk about some root causes. Why does someone harm someone else?
Well, I think hurt people hurt people. I think every child is born good and precious and valuable, and things happen to them that disconnect them from their truth. And a lot of people do what they know. When they know better, they can do better. A lot of perpetrators of domestic violence were actually a victim at one point in their life, usually in childhood.
Okay.
I just wanted to co-sign what Darla said. And it is for us, it's imperative to be self-conscious and aware that there is a component that we work in our program in ADAPT that we talk about the core value, our own core value as human beings. And it is something that we have since the day that we're born. And we can get disconnected from that core value. We can get disconnected through our childhood experiences, as Darla mentioned, and also unresolved trauma as we grow. And there are many layers and components, of course, but that root cause, it's very much attached to our upbringing and the things that we were exposed to. And at times, the relationships that were lack of probably like that compassion component and empathy. And it is something that that at times is very difficult to just immediately highlight because it has probably a lot of history. So that I think I wanted to just to add that.
So even if somebody says they can change and they really believe they will change and they can change, as you guys are saying, but can a victim believe them?
I think behavior and words need to match. People mm-hmm. can say that all day long. But if the behaviors are not matching, then no, they shouldn't believe it. I tell people, rewind the movie, watch it with no words. That's your truth. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, the words and behaviors match, you're golden. If not, get with behaviors.
Okay. But simply wanting to stop, because I'm assuming that if I am causing harm, if I'm someone who causes harm to someone I love, that I don't want to be doing this. But simply not wanting to do it isn't enough, is it?
No, definitely. You have to assume accountability, and accountability comes in many different components. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important of those, yes, it's not committing the similar harm, which is like, you know, stopping that harm. Mm-hmm. But you have to understand a very essential component of the harm that you have caused to yourself and to the other person or the other person who was on the receiving end. Understanding that harm that was caused, you know, had some ramifications or consequences. Expressing that remorse, it's imperative. And taking actions to repair that harm, it is crucial. So it definitely, you know, it's a little bit more than just obviously, you know, just stopping it. Because we want to work to prevent that from happening again, but also from hurting ourselves too.
And I want to add that a lot of times these are almost like PTSD responses. If their triggers are attached to a previous trauma, which most are, mm-hmm. things that take someone from 0 to 100 in a nanosecond, I guarantee you are connected to a past hurt experience. And all the psychoeducation, CBT in the world is not going to address PTSD. So if their trigger response is a PTSD response, we need to get healing from that past trauma. Then they now have the bandwidth in there to choose a different coping skill, to choose a different thought process, to have accountability. But a lot of times these are, you know, autonomic responses to a past trauma. And so it requires more than, you know, it requires healing, and they deserve it.
You both mentioned accountability.
Mm-hmm.
I can't, you can't, someone else can't hold someone accountable. That's my understanding. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Has to be internal.
Okay. What does research in this area say about whether people can really change? Is there research?
There is. Most of the research is saying we need more research. That's what most of the research is saying. It really is. It's a hard thing to research because every program is a little different. There's not this strict, you know, this is the curriculum. This is how you do it. Everybody comes from a different modality. Some are more trauma informed. But research is showing that programs that are trauma informed have better results. Programs that are motivational based have better results. Programs based on treatment effectiveness and using evidence-based activities and presentations are, you know, have better results. But definitely most research says we need more research.
Okay. I'll take a quick pause here to remind our listeners that if any part of today's conversation triggers them, they can call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. What are some signs that someone really does want to change? if I'm a partner of someone who's been causing harm to me or to someone else in the family, what should I be looking for that says that they really are doing what needs to be done? I know you said behavior has to match the words, mm-hmm. but any other...
Right, actions. Yeah, actions. They're reaching out for help. A willingness. Voicing accountability. Those that want to change, you know, will own what they're doing. Those that are not ready to change, they're blaming others. They're not owning. They're not accountable. So owning and reaching out for help. Because a lot of times just wanting to change is not enough.
And one additional component, it's as a sign, it's the emotional self-regulation component. And when we are talking about emotional self-regulation, we are definitely not reacting the same way that we used to. We definitely are taking the time to think before necessarily acting. We're controlling ourselves. And that will include, you know, a lot of coping skills and mechanisms that we have heard before, like deep breathing exercises, taking a walk, also relying on your own strengths as a person, what things help you to calm down. But in terms of like behaviors and actions that are very tangible, one of those things is like having the willingness to sit down and talk, not to confront somebody, not utilizing, like Darla said, like the blaming game that hurts so much, that it's rooted in looking in the back, in the past, and instead of focusing on the solution. But it is an important component here of like, be willing to talk, be willing to look for a solution, and to commit to that. Those are signs that that we could see, like in individuals struggling with this, that they can increase like a little bit. And it's important to note those, mm-hmm. right? It's important to know that these are also signs of someone who's trying to approach this differently, who's trying to react differently to the triggers, to starting to create a switch in their brain to make sure that we don't fall into the same pattern or in the same situation that brought us to that point. Looking for help, it is part of the accountability aspect that I was talking earlier, like taking actions to repair mm-hmm. that harm. Taking actions to repair that harm when you're looking for, you know, for help and you're trying to process this in any way, whether it's in a group setting, individual, traditional setting, or any other setting, spiritually, you're taking actions to repair that harm. And that is crucial. And that is also something that is tangible, that the partner or anybody who has suffered, has been harmed, can also consider.
So you mentioned, Darla, that, you know, the programs may differ in how they operate. But let's, in generalities, talk about what a domestic violence intervention program is. What do they do? Help.
Right. And because there are certain components that need to be there on the state board that certifies programs. So, you know, you have to have certain things in place. But a domestic violence program involves accountability. It involves the ability to self-soothe, the ability to self-regulate your emotions. And most, well, if they're in that program, they don't have that ability mm-hmm. usually. It involves healing. Absolutely. I feel so strongly in addressing that it involves healing from past trauma. We're doing a lot of inner child work. I mean, they're spending time with that little boy or that little girl who was not safe. Because I believe that their problem today was actually their solution back then. And they're now carrying it into adulthood, and it's getting in the way. It's getting in the way of healthy relationships. It involves psychoeducation on what's healthy, what's not healthy. Relationship skills, healthy communication. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be really mm-hmm. angry. It's not okay to be aggressive. So how do you get that anger out in an assertive way instead of an aggressive way, in a way that doesn't push people away or disrespect them or yourself. It's changing their locus of control from external to internal, which means instead of blaming, somebody else needs to change for me to be okay or be healthy. Looking inward, what's in my control to change this? It's increasing support systems, the ability to identify emotions. Most, it's, you know, they're happy, they're mad. Well, what's under the mad? Anger is not, does not ride alone. There's a deeper emotion, which is your truth. What is it? Do I feel unappreciated, betrayed, hurt, lonely, shame? Being able to, you know, identify what's in there and how do you get it out in a healthy way? In session, we're doing a lot of mindfulness meditation so they can experience the ability to self-soothe. Their body and brain tends to be in what's called sympathetic nervous system. Because of past experiences, they're just wired on guard. On guard, on guard. Their window of tolerance is really narrow. And so we want to take the foot off the gas pedal, right? People are focusing on the exhaust coming out, the behaviors. Well, let's focus on the deeper thing that's keeping that gas pedal down. And so there's a whole lot involved, but we've got lots of weeks to cover this over and over and over to make lasting changes and healing.
Okay, so how many weeks?
Well, in the state of Virginia, it has to be a minimum of 18 weeks if you're doing a two-hour, but 24 is the minimum. Most, we have 24 and 36. Virginia is actually the lowest 10% of the states in length of treatment. Many of the states have up to 52 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So we are hoping to change that for more high-risk offenders. But it's usually 24 to 36 weeks, depending on risk factors.
Urban Adapt is 18 weeks, correct?
It is 18 weeks, and we are moving also forward alongside with what has been approved by the Domestic Violence Intervention Programs Board, which is utilizing the approach of the level of risk, specifically with 52, 36, and 24. So we are going to transition that in the near future, and that will involve changes, as Darla was mentioning, focusing on the internal and external components of it. And there is a lot of processing too. Kendra, and I just wanted to add just this 2 cents. There are many activities that we do in the ADAPT program, and I can recall always that there's when we are covering topics as resentment, for example, the amount of vulnerability that comes out of those activities are speaking so loud about some of those internal struggles, some of those past experiences, some of those things that they've been holding, not just only towards their partners, but probably towards their parents. And they have not been resolved. And sometimes allowing that space for them to process, to maybe at least externalize this for the first time in their lives, it's crucial. And this is not only coming from my testimony as a facilitator, it's coming from their own words. They have been able to say, like, I have just acknowledged how much anger I had or I've been holding for so long. And this is one of the benefits of participating in this type of services. So, you know, not to go on a rabbit hole here because there's a lot. And you know how passionate we are about the work that we do, but this is also important to highlight.
So are both programs group only?
Ours is a combination. It's mostly group. We offer individual sessions if they want to come in and work one-on-one to do some deeper trauma work. We do something called eye movement integration that reduces PTSD responses. It's extremely effective. And so we offer that to for them to come in. We also offer, once they complete, they get free couples counseling and free family counseling. The system, right? It's not normally, you know, our biggest feedback is, well, I'm learning all this. However, my partner or my family, you know, has been affected and is not. So we do that to try to ensure success, if they can have a healthier environment where everybody's learning that. But I don't think it can be a cookie cutter, one size fits all. So depending on the assessment results, we may do more individual and then put them in group, or, you know, we kind of try to tailor it to the individual participants' needs, but mostly group.
How do we measure success? Is success, they completed the program and they don't need further help? Is success, they come back and say, this really worked and this is why? Is it a partner coming and saying, thank God you guys helped? How do we measure success?
It's measured a lot of different ways. One, in order to get a certificate, they have to show that they can do empathy. The number one predictor that someone will reoffend is their, that will not reoffend is their ability to do empathy. One of the more powerful lessons is they're writing an empathy essay. They have to write about the incident that happened as if they are the other person. And I have so many tell me that this is one of the hardest things they've done, and it shifts. So they have to be able to do empathy, be able to see from another person's perspective. We have a pre and post test that, you know, measures that they've learned. We rate their stage of change. So maybe most come in pre-contemplative. I don't have a problem. I don't belong here. And there's different stages of change depending on how they present. And we want to see them move to contemplative, to planning, to action, to maintenance. And then there's recidivism that's run on group members, on, you know, the clients. And so, you know, you can track recidivism, how many are reoffending. So there's a lot of different ways to measure success. It's, you know, not one easy way. And a lot of it is you see the change, but that's not, you know, something that, well, I see that they've changed. You see a shift, you see their heart change, you see them get relief and healing.
Just only wanted to add, it's really hard to measure it in a way that, and I utilize this word because at times we come into conversations where people are looking for stats, people are looking for this data, that it's sustainable, that it's evidence. And at times in this field, specifically in the domestic violence field with this population, it's really hard to find something that meets that requirement. Everything that Darla said, it's something that I can relate to, because we have also an activity that is called a healing letter activity, that is the last thing that they do. And then, you know, it's kind of interesting that our activity is called healing letter activity, which is like almost an opportunity for them to actually look inside themselves and see how they are in this journey, in this healing journey, as I call it. I always tell my clients, like, when you join the ADAPT program, imagine that you're crossing that bridge, right? And in that bridge, on the other side is that healing part, that you're feeling that more in peace with yourself. You feel that you're more self-compassionate. You feel that you're making better decisions with your partner, with your loved ones. And sometimes some of them are just at the beginning of that healing journey. Some of them are kind of in the middle of it because they have done some prior work before that. And sometimes the last track in that healing journey regarding those issues are offering that opportunity that they can gain. And I think that through that healing letter, one of the most important things is that accountability, is showing that you're owning what happened. But at the same time, this letter allows them to revisit what they have been doing in ADAPT. They finish the letter with a plan that either they are following at this moment, or they're proposing so that they can prevent from committing that same harm. And you might say, you know, people can mask and can just, you know, create a letter that meets the requirement, right, for the eye or for the ears. But doing a genuine exercise will allow you to touch base with the very best part of you. And that is the healing component that we believe in. And coming at times in that, you know, from that session, from that experience, it's truly rewarding because you could see how much they have tried to work on some of these things. And at times it's very hard to convince a panel and say, like, this is my experience. And I have worked with, I don't know, like more than 30, 40 groups so far in my almost 5 years. And that's what I have seen. So I encourage anybody who's listening to this to contribute and continue allowing us and help us to maybe in the future, the near future, to have the opportunity to do longitudinal study that allows us to maybe like measure this in a way that we can access to a data that it's probably more tangible for anybody. Because I think we will benefit a lot from it. I think all across the board.
Like Darla said, more research. You mentioned, Irvin, join, adapt. Are most of your clients court mandated? Darla's question is for you as well.
Yes, I'd say almost all of them are. Our program is Peaceful Choices, the name of the program. And probably at least 99% are court mandated. They come in, they don't need to be there. They don't want to be there. I'm the Antichrist. It's like, you know, what do you think you're going to teach me? And so yes, are, it is, it, my favorite population to work with because change is so moving to see. I know a group member that walks in that's the biggest, baddest. I know they've got the biggest pain. I don't see a big, bad, evil person. I see a hurt little boy or a hurt little girl. And when you come from that place and you get to see the healing and see the change, it is profound. But yes, most are court ordered. And I just want to add that the court order, when they're done, almost every one of them is like, I never would have done this. And I'm so glad I did. Like, wow. Yes,
that was
wow.
My next part of the discussion. If something is court mandated, if I'm ordered to do this.
Right. So they're there for
devil's
right.
advocate, less likely to participate fully.
In the beginning.
Yeah.
And then they
correct.
Start to feel the positive effects and they want more of that. I had one group member when he was done, he's like, do you sell gift certificates for this? Because I'd like to give this for Christmas gifts to some my family members. I'm like, well, no, but I can write you one. And that was probably one of the biggest, baddest that didn't want to be there, you know. So that's, I mean, the testimonies are huge.
That is correct. That is definitely correct. And I think it's beautiful what you were saying, because that is probably one of our common experiences of, specifically my groups, like when they're getting to that last end of the sessions, they're saying like, do we have a couple of more left? And sometimes they say like, is there any way that we can continue, like, you know, working in other groups or stuff like that? And it is very telling. But I also rely a lot on, even they come with those reservations and maybe like they feel like they're forced, they're obligated, and they don't want to be here. I trust a lot in what we the ground foundation that we try to promote since the beginning, that allows them to feel like we are not a court. This is different. We're not going to be judged here for what we've done. We're going to be treated here with human dignity. We are going to promote a lot of compassion and empathy in the way that we talk, the way that we communicate, in the way that we provide the material. And that is something that I hold myself very much towards to, like, you know, as a high standard. And I feel very proud in saying this also alongside with my coworkers, because we try to provide that so that that wall can start coming down. And at times it comes down pretty early, and the earlier the better, because they will feel more vulnerable to do the work and they will feel more free to actually navigate through what we are going to try to teach them and at times try to help them the process. So it's great and also very profound, like Darla said.
Is this something like alcohol, substance abuse, where once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, even when you're no longer drinking, but you're actively monitoring for the rest of your life? Is this similar?
No, and I just want to say, like, it's not similar in a way that, in my experience, right? In terms of, like, how condemning at times that sounds, that approach,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, we try to, during our program, to help them a lot with those, you know, shame-inducing, like, thoughts and everything that has been probably repeated to them for so long, even the labeling of how in many documents they're called offenders, they're called perpetrators, they're called abusers. We call them just individuals who cause harm, or we call them by their name because they have a name. And the reason in our program, right, because I understand there is another component to having, you know, that accountability of being somebody who offended somebody, right? And having that name or that label for the victim side, that is also very important for them to get that reassurance. But in our program with them, we try to stay away from those things. And because of that, I think it's, we offer something different so they can always and forever utilize the tools that we provide them in group. So that is something that will help anybody to check in with themselves. And this is starting with me, with Irving. Like, the tools that we provide are also applicable to me. Like,
to everyone.
I get angry. How I respond to it, that is a huge, the difference at times. So we try to tell them that these tools, you can utilize them forever. This emotional self-regulating techniques, you can utilize them forever. That doesn't mean that you forever will be known or you'll feel that you are someone who caused harm. That is something we try for them to see it as, that voice of shame, not
just
them.
Just real quick, you know, no one is born aggressive. Somebody may be born wired for addiction. That's when you talk about in recovery forever. You know, someone isn't born wired aggressive. So, you know, when you get the healing, when they get the coping, there's no finish line. We're all learning and growing forever. We're all going to miss the mark sometimes and need to learn from it. But when they get the healing and they change their thought processes and they get back aligned to their truth that they're good and worthy and valuable, then it's different than needing to be in recovery.
Okay. That'll do it for this episode of Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Irvin and Darla for joining us and sharing their expertise. If you or someone you know has experienced interpersonal violence, call the Domestic and Sexual Violence 24-hour hotline at 703-360-7273. That's 703-360-7273. Or visit fairfaxcounty.gov and search for domestic and sexual violence. To listen to other Fairfax County government podcasts, visit www.fairfaxcounty.gov/podcasts. Unscripted, Conversations about Sexual and Domestic Violence is produced by the Fairfax County, Virginia government.